The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Euro Trash Special. La Liga starts today, the Bundesliga is in full swing and Serie A is gearing up to get going in 9 days' time. We'll tell you everything you need to know about all the restarts, so I'll be asking the panel some tough questions on matters you may have forgotten about since lockdown, such as who's top of the league, who plays for who, who's good? A real test then for Sid, Nicky and Archie. We'll have generic questions about Bale, Messi and Ronaldo. We'll discuss the Champions League moving to Portugal. And we've got fans hiding in forests in Germany. And the only reason we're all here, the denouement to Archie's Tinder tales. All that plus your questions on today's Guardian Football Weekly. Sid Lowe is in Madrid. Hey, Sid.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, tremendous. Thanks very much. Archie Rintat is in Cologne. Hello, Archie.
Hello, Max.
And Nicky Bandini is in Brighton. Nicky.
That's right.
I don't know, Nicky, if you've looked into when you can next get to Italy. I know you spend most of your time and career here, but I wonder if you've been scanning and trying to find out when you can next get to the motherland.
It's really complicated. I mean, I think actually getting there just sort of... The part of getting there isn't the difficult part. The difficult part is if you plan to return, of course, 14 days of quarantine. And also, what benefit is there going to be in going there at the moment when, even though the games are restarting, they're not letting in a huge number of journalists. I think it's going to be 10 journalists per game to begin with. So the chances of me actually getting an accreditation in the short term are not that high because I'll go to domestic journalists first. So it might be a while before it's purposeful for me to go there. Obviously, I have family as well I'd like to see. But yeah, it's... Very much working that out as we go at the moment.
Sid, are you going to go to games? Do you have the same issue as Nicky would have?
Yeah, in fact, it's even tighter in Spain, at least for the moment. The La Liga protocol originally had no provision at all for journalists outside of club's own media. The Consejo Superior de Deportes, which is effectively the sports ministry, intervened and said that the journalists should be allowed in. So at the moment, it's six per game. And the league starts up today. With the Seville derby. Actually, there was a game yesterday, which was Rayo Vallecano against Albacete, half of a game that had been postponed way back in January, I think it was, because of course, Rayo fans accused Roman Fafulia of being a Nazi, and so the game got cancelled. And what they've said is, yes, we're going to let them in, and it's going to be six written journalists. Now, of course, as I say, we're starting today, but we still don't know for certain what the actual criteria is. So it looks like it's in the hands of the club. It was originally handed on to the Association of the Press in Spain, and they didn't want to be involved. Of course, he didn't want to be involved because there was going to be loads of people really pissed off no matter what they chose. So at the moment, we're not entirely sure. It looks like the criteria is going to be based on the EGM, which is, a study of which media is the most read. And that'll be done province by province. So within each province, the six most read media will be the ones that go. But with some discretionary powers from the clubs. So we actually don't know what's happening, although we do think that there may well be an international place at some games. But let's face it, for the really big ones, it's not going to happen.
Archie, I was going to say, how do you get into games then? Are you more important than Sid and Nicky? Or just it. Like everything?
We'll go, Max. Like... We'll leave you in Archie.
Or is it just like everything else? Germany's just better at this than the rest of us?
No, so in Germany, there's only 10 written press allowed per game, but that's now been increased, actually, because I think alongside rights holders, the total number of journalists they're allowing in is going up from 13 to 26. That was announced on Wednesday. And also, you've got slight lifting of restrictions as well, so that the fourth official, players, coaches, support staff, who are on the bench will no longer have to wear masks and that. But the only reason I've been getting in is because I work as a freelancer for the Bundesliga World Feed, which means they're one of the very few that, along with Sky and then the two terrestrial broadcasters, ARD and ZDF, that they're one of the few that have people inside. So I'd say it's more akin to having the golden ticket to Willy Wonka's chocolate factory more than anything, because it's like luck of who you're with. I know in the Premier League that they're going to be letting in 25 written journalists per game. So, and I still think there'll be quite a bun fight for that as well. The way they've done it in Germany has worked well so far. And I think particularly now, the fact they've got the end of the season in sight, they're just desperate to get it finished.
Okay then, Sid. Set out the plans and the dates for La Liga then? It starts today. Just set it all out for people who have probably forgotten everything that was happening in La Liga before the pandemic hit.
Okay, so I mean, it's very simple, as you say. It starts today with a Seville derby, Sevilla against Betis. There are 11 rounds of games left to play. Those are going to be played in just under 5 weeks. So essentially, there will be football every day for, I think it's 33 days. Although that may not happen, because the last two rounds of games, people may have to play simultaneously, of course, because there'll be certain things in play. So they might not be able to stretch them out. But the idea is that each round of games will take up 3 or 4 days of the week. Then we'll go straight into the next round of games and all the way through. It's weird in a way when you think about it as being 11 rounds of games left, because, you know, obviously we're at the start of June, because this has gone so long, because we're into the summer now, and because it's being compacted, it feels like we're really near the end of the season, but we're not. I mean, 11 games is nearly a third of the season still to go. So you know, it starts up now. There's a little bit of concern about any problems that might happen, which is one of the reasons why they're making it so quick, to give themselves that two weeks extra at the end of the season between the domestic season ending and probable European football starting, just in case there's a problem and they have to move things on or hold things back and fill them in later on. But yeah, basically, football every day for, I think it's 33, 34 days.
And how does that compare with Serie A, Nicky?
So there's two things going on in Italy. Of course, Serie A is coming back on the 20th of June. We actually have the Coppa Italia coming back on Friday and Saturday, and then the final being played on Wednesday. So we have a sort of an antipasto almost for the main course of the season that's coming up. The season itself, when it starts, is going to be 124 games in 44 days. There's an extra round more than Spain left to go. And then you also have eight teams that have another game on top of that. So Inter and seven others have 13 games left to play. The rest have 12 left to play. And potentially for Inter, which is why I named them, they have this Coppa Italia semi-final second leg to play this weekend, and potentially the final as well if they were to qualify for it. So you have a quite crazy amount of games coming up between now and the 2nd of August, which is the intended end date, and some significant challenges around that as well, because I'd be interested to know what the protocol is in every other country, frankly, because right now in Italy, the rule is still that if one player on one team is diagnosed positive, the whole team has to go into quarantine for 14 days, which, as you can see, when you're playing games twice a week, isn't really going to work.
Question from Germany to Italy and Spain. We don't generally have heat waves here. That's not an issue in June. But in Italy and Spain, I'm imagining that it's quite hot. Like, are there going to be kind of, I don't know, any heat breaks or sort of issues there? Because, I mean, in Germany, that's not really a problem here. Like, the climate is quite temperate. But I can imagine that playing in Madrid at the height of June, for example, could be a little bit difficult for the players in some way.
Yeah, this is a very, very conscious part of the planning here. So, for example, even last night in this half of the game that they played between Rayo and Albacete, there was a drinks break. You look at the fixtures, the league are putting the fixtures out, and the fixtures show obviously home team, away team, date, home team, away team, kickoff time, projected temperature and maximum temperature. Because of course, what they're saying is if we do have to move it for temperatures, we will. And 30 degrees is the point at which they intervene for things like drinks breaks and so on. And that has led to, if you look at the fixtures, you see a very, very clear north-south divide. So the games that are kicking off in the afternoon, now most of the games are being pushed very late. The Seville derby, for example, kicks off at 10 o'clock. But you look at the games played over the weekend, the earlier kickoff games are all in the north. So they play all the games in the north when theoretically it'll be hotter, and all the games in the south when it'll be, sorry, the other way around, north where it's going to be cooler, in the south where it's going to be hotter. And they're very, very conscious of that. Now, of course, the problem is that that's not always quite as clear cut as that. You don't always have a handy number of northern games and a handy number of southern games. But that's why, or at least that's what they say, that's why we haven't got the fixture list for the whole season already, which frankly I think we should have, considering it's only a 3 week round of 3 weeks of games that we don't know about. But because they're saying, well, we want to wait and see what the projected temperatures are for each place, because if we're in a situation in which, by surprise, we can play a game in the south a little bit earlier on and mix the TV times up, we're going to want to do that. But at the moment, their hands are tied by how hot it will be. And yeah, down in the south, it's going to be incredibly hot at this time of year.
Yeah, so Italy has scheduled the games for Serie A, and they've moved basically all of them to evening games. There are, I think, 8 games out of those 124 that are going to be played at 5:15 p.m. local time. Everything else is later. And of those 8 games, I think only one of them isn't what you'd in what you'd call the north of Italy. There's one game in Rome, I think, for Lazio that's currently at 5:15. They've introduced a new time slot for Italy, which is the 9:45 kickoff. Not quite as late as Spain, but definitely that's, you know, that's a new departure for Italy. And I think, yeah, it's all absolutely a reaction to the temperature and that consideration. And I think perhaps there's also a tiny little bit of thought in people's minds as well that, hey, you know, this is reacting to circumstance, but maybe it'll work out for us in terms of being able to get new international audiences because of the times of kickoff.
How are they scheduling the games in terms of television? We were talking on Monday about at what point we'll crack. Will it be when it's Burnley Crystal Palace on a Monday night after 15 days solid of Premier League football? I mean, Sid, are they putting every game on in Spain?
Yeah, but in a way, you know, in a way that's not, it doesn't feel like a leap because Spain already did that. So unlike the Premier League, Spain doesn't have a kind of a standardised kickoff time, which say five or six games are grouped into. Spain was already in a process, and this is one of the reasons why they were fighting with the Federation about having Monday night games, of having 10 games in 10 different time slots. So you get every single game on television anyway. And the other thing that was happening was, you know, as I said, we've got games every day. But as Javier Tebas, the president of the league, pointed out, and he was quite right, he said, look, this is no different from what it would be at the back end of the season anyway. Admittedly, those games every day would include some European games in the middle of it. You know, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday would be European games. But La Liga was already in a process in which it was having games Friday, Saturday, Sunday and Monday. Although, as I say, there was a battle over whether or not they were allowed to have the Monday games. And so, yeah, they are spreading this out. And yeah, they are making absolutely every game available. And that does ask the question that at the moment we're all saying, oh, we'll watch anything. But to be honest, in a few weeks' time, when Levante play Valladolid, we probably won't be watching it. But that was already the case.
I guess the real point is that the fans of those clubs can watch the games, which is important. Nikki, what are they doing in Italy?
Yeah, I mean, I was curious to know if anything like this is happening in Spain. So one of the reasons they decided to put the Coppa Italia first is because the Coppa Italia is held by the domestic free-to-air broadcaster. So those games are going to be televised for free on national TV. They are trying to arrange to have at least some of the games that would normally be held by Sky and DAZN also put onto domestic TV. But there's really complicated area around this in Italian law because they have this legge Melandri, the Melandri article, which basically means that once rights have been sold to a particular rights holder, they are not allowed to transfer them. They're not allowed to push them onto someone else. And, you know, it's a bureaucratic hurdle, which Sky are open to moving some of these games onto TV Otto, which is, you know, TV Otto, which is a partner of theirs, which they could, you know, still get some benefit from and would be open to all. But so far that hasn't been worked out. That's still being discussed with the Minister for the Interior, indeed, sort of getting involved and trying to work it out. So hopefully there will be a bunch of games on domestic in Italy, but at the moment it's not been.
Yeah, from a Spanish point of view, in terms of the broadcasting of games, these games, the process will be the same in terms of where you see them. So in other words, every round of games, there'll be one free-to-air game, which is protected by law in Spain, and the rest are all on subscription TV. The league has announced that it will make all games available for free in care homes and hospitals, as a gesture through the crisis. What they haven't done is the thing that I've been beating my head against the wall with, and no one seems to be listening, which is pretty much normal for me, I suppose. I still think that they, as a very, very basic package, whether it's the league that pays for it, the clubs that pay for it, or the broadcasters that pay for it, or a combination of the three, I still think that season ticket holders of their clubs should get their games for free. Maybe not the others, but the games that you were going to go to anyway, they should get for free. And I've raised this in Spanish media three or four times, and every time I've raised it, people have said, oh, that's a good idea, and then the story dies. No one cares.
Well, Sid, I think it's a good idea. Moving on.
hey!
Archie, I want to talk about supporters because there were quite a few sets of German ultras who protested about games being played. Have they gone quiet since it's all gone quite smoothly, or are they still making a noise about this?
So, in Cologne, because when I go and have a socially distanced kickabout, albeit restrictions are lifting all the time here, you wouldn't know that it was coronavirus times or had been anymore because everything's just now open. I go past the Cologne Stadium, and before every home game, there've still been banners up from the ultras. However, I would aim some criticism at the ultras because whoever they've got putting their banners up is not doing a very good job because the wind is taking good care of them every single time. So they need to really have an internal inquiry about that. But I don't think that the ultras see this as going quiet. It's more them saying, look, We've set out our stall. We're not taking an interest in this. This is not football as we see it. But they've also laid out what their idea of how football should be in the future, i.e. they've said as well that they think that things should be more sustainable, that clubs need to be aiming towards that to make sure that such a situation where they're forced into playing like this for the TV money doesn't happen again, which is just a continuation really of the, I guess, idealistic ways that they are trying to push the league in. And I think if you want to know why German supporters get stuff, it's because they protest at all times. Like, no matter when the point is, they will always make a point to protest. And yeah, I think there's a reason why they have this sort of power. Obviously, it's intrinsically linked with their ownership of clubs as well, with the 50+1 rule in the majority of cases. But I think that their grassroots organisation is excellent as well.
Nicky, ultradom is slightly different in Italy. I think that's fair to say. But I just wonder if what the fans, or if fans are protesting about these games going on behind closed doors over there.
Yeah, some are. And I think this is a really sort of difficult question to answer when people say, how are people responding to the return of football? There are absolutely some ultra groups that are protesting about it. You've had Atalanta fans, Genoa fans, Brescia fans, I'm sure some other groups that have gone and hung banners basically outside training grounds or stadiums saying, we don't want this, you know, this is disrespectful, people have died, those sorts of messages. But yeah, this has come up time and time again in recent seasons with all sorts of different topics, whether it's racist chanting, whether it's how the quarterfinal gets separated. The ultras and the rest of the fan base do not necessarily see this in the same way. So there are definitely people who are opposed to the return of football in Italy. There are also definitely groups of fans who you might say are not necessarily acting in line with the idea of the current state of lockdown relaxation, even if it's perhaps sometimes in line with the letter of it, which is, for instance, Regina fans. Their team just got promoted by incomplete season. Regina just came up from the third tier to Serie B that we're playing in next season. And there was a huge street party in Regina, fans out in the streets and having a big celebration. A lot of people looking at that and going, is that a great idea right now when the country, yes, is coming out of lockdown restrictions, but coronavirus hasn't been totally eliminated in Italy. So there's a lot going on. A lot of it is localised. A lot of it is different opinions, even within different fan bases. So it's hard to sort of generalise, but there's definitely a contingent that is opposed to football restarting.
I mean, right or wrong, that street party certainly wouldn't have been as shit as a sort of a British conga, you know, a socially distant conga that we've seen. I just imagine the Italians are better at that than we are. What about the players? Has there been universal buy-in into coming back in Spain, Sid?
Yeah, I mean, in Spain, the famous case was a guy called Fali, who plays at Cadiz in the second division, who said he wasn't going to come back. And it was interesting listening to him because he sounded genuinely terrified. I mean, clearly this had become a big issue for him on a personal level. He said he hadn't left the house. I mean, during the lockdown, hadn't even gone to the supermarket, literally hadn't left the house, was really worried about it, refused to go back. And it was actually reasonably well handled, because rather than just kind of attacking him, there was, I think, a sense of, OK, we understand that you're frightened and we're going to work with you. And so Cadiz, for example, weren't threatening him and saying, you've got to come back or we'll sack you or anything like that. And actually, he returned to training. Talking to a lot of players over the last couple of weeks, this kind of return to work protocol has been very strange for them. And particularly in that first week, of course, where they go back to training and they're wearing masks and they turn up in their kit and they leave in their kit and they're training on their own, even if they can see a teammate kind of 4 metres away further down the pitch. But I think they've, you know, because the process has been quite long, I think most of them are actually really quite happy about it. We've seen very few positive tests, or at least we've been told about very few positive tests. And you always have that doubt about whether there might be some that you're not being told about. The law, to go back to something you were mentioning earlier, is different, for example, to Italy. If there is a positive test, that player is isolated, but not the whole squad. So that player is effectively treated as if they were injured. They have to then pass a test twice before they're allowed back into the group. And so I think actually most players are reasonably relaxed about it now. What they don't know, of course, is how it's going to feel when the games themselves start.
We've seen in Germany, like, at the start, you had all this, okay, whenever someone scores a goal, got to make sure that everyone's just touching elbows and no, like, big communal celebrations. But as the weeks have gone by, it's been funny how that's become more and more relaxed, and everybody's laughing at the end of Freiburg's win against Gladbach last Friday night because Christian Streich, the Freiburg coach, is just kind of is almost punching his fellow coaching staff just because he's grabbing them so tightly. So I wonder if the whole restrictions, the fear will wear off steadily as it has here, because yeah, communal celebrations are happening again. If there's a big last minute goal, people aren't able to control themselves in quite the same way. But I guess it also depends on what's happening in each country as well regarding how the coronavirus is being viewed, because here it's just really pared down.
There's the really important issue of player protest regards Black Lives Matter. We talked about it a lot on the pod that came out yesterday. Archie, remind us how the league have kind of supported it, if that's the right word. Is that the right word?
Yeah. Well, because originally there are rules in Germany which say that political protest is not allowed, there was a lot of eyes towards the German FA, the DFB, being like, okay, what are you going to do about this then? And Fritz Keller came out with a statement last week, the president of the German FA, saying the players have our respect and understanding for their actions. Nothing will be done. So that's been encouraging. And since then, we saw the likes of Weston and McKennie wearing a Black Lives Matter armband. You saw Ashraf Hakimi, Jadon Sancho, both of Borussia Dortmund, and Marcus Thuram taking a knee, for example. Hakimi and Sancho both had Justice for George Floyd on their shirts. And then last weekend, you had several games where beforehand, every player of Dortmund, Hertha Berlin, Wolfsburg, Werder Bremen, Union Berlin, Schalke all took a knee around the center circle. So it's being accepted, and I'd say that everybody here has very much got on board with it.
We had lots of questions specifically about Italy, Nicky, about whether anyone has said anything, any team, organization, or the league itself.
There hasn't been a league position taken. There's certainly been several individual players who've made comments on Twitter. I think Ashley Young was one of the first. Romelu Lukaku has. Giorgio Chiellini had quite a heartfelt post, you know, asking how is he supposed to explain to his kids what could happen to George Floyd, that could happen in a civilized society, that's possible. Roma, I know, shared a photo of the whole first team kneeling in a sort of similar way to how Liverpool had training and giving their sign. There hasn't been a unified response, but there's certainly plenty of individual ones and from players and teams. The thing that I have heard talked about in Italy, and of course this is only talked about, but a thing that I've heard talked about is how is this going to impact things when fans do come back? Is it going to be so far down the line when fans come back that it's just forgotten about, that it doesn't matter? Because in this context right now, if we were playing games today, could you really still have that same element of idiots who are making monkey chants in stadiums, who think it's okay to be provocative in that way, who think it's not really racism, it's just sort of a justifiable way to get at players? And if that did happen, would you see a different reaction from the majority? Because it is the majority that is not taking part in this always when these things come up. Would you see a different reaction from the majority of fans in the stadium who aren't doing it? Would you see them react in a more hostile way towards that element? And that's a question that is being talked about in Italy, it's being asked, but of course we won't really get an answer on that because there's not going to be fans in the stadium for a while.
Has there been any official line from La Liga, Sid?
No, not in Spain. There hasn't been. I mean, it sounds like it's broadly similar to Italy in that obviously a lot of clubs have made statements. A lot of clubs have done videos, for example. Obviously players have spoken out, but there hasn't been, if you like, kind of an institutional response to it at a time actually where La Liga have been very proactive in their messaging. So perhaps it's slightly surprising. There is possibly in Spain a slightly different view of what's happening in the US because of the political divide anyway. So maybe that makes this perhaps for some people at least not as clear cut. But I think most clubs and most players are backing it, but on an individual level. There's the one thing that I was really struck by was there was an event organised by La Liga with its ambassadors around about, it must be, what would it be, 8-9 days ago, and a series of ambassadors talking about the return to the league and so on. And it wasn't about Black Lives Matter. That wasn't up for discussion. It wasn't part of the conversation. But at the very end, Freddy Kanute, who's always been very aware, very prepared to speak out on numerous issues, including, for example, a few years ago when he was at Seville and he covered the sponsor because the sponsor was a betting company and that kind of thing. And at the very end of this, and no one had said anything, he said, I would like to talk about another virus and talk about the racism. And it was only a very, very brief intervention. But then that led to the representative from La Liga saying, well, and of course, La Liga, you know, supports your position and we're proud to have ambassadors like you. But I think they were slightly caught on the hop by it. And so they've said they back it, but hasn't been an institutional response as yet from the league.
All right. Well, that'll do for part one. In part two, we'll actually discuss football that's going to take place. Welcome back to the Guardian Football Weekly. We have a title race in Italy and in Spain. Champions League spots up for grabs, relegation as well. I mean, it's been so long, I can barely remember who plays for any of these teams. Can we start with La Liga, Sid? Barcelona on 58 points, Real Madrid 56. Then there's a 9-point gap. Did the break come at a particularly good or bad time for either of those teams?
I think it's impossible to know for certain. I mean, just to respond to your thing about forgetting, genuinely, and obviously he'll remain nameless because I don't want to embarrass him, but a colleague of mine sent a message yesterday and said, I'd completely forgotten who the manager of Valencia was. And it does feel like that. I mean, admittedly, in the case of the manager of Valencia, it's Albert Celades, by the way. He's not an enormously charismatic man, so I suppose it's possible that you can forget him. I don't know whether it came at a good time for them. We are in that position, aren't we, where there's so much that we don't know how they'll respond. I mean, I guess you could look at it and say, let's look at the potential benefits of this. I suppose from Barcelona's point of view, you could say there is a potential benefit that you've got a newish manager in Quique Setién trying to do something very different. And maybe this has given him the time to do something very different in terms of the structure, the way they want to play and so on. Obviously, from Barcelona's point of view, there's one really obvious big advantage from this, which is Luis Suarez is fit again. Now, we thought Luis Suarez wouldn't play again this season. Personally, I thought there was a good chance Luis Suarez might never play for Barcelona again because, of course, they were looking at replacements in the summer. And he's now back and he's fit. So that's a big advantage. But if you take it to Real Madrid's side, well, they've got a similar situation with Eden Hazard, who we didn't think would play a particularly big role, if a role at all, in the back end of this season. And he's now fit, and they say, although obviously it's easy to say this off training, we don't know until we get into games, they say he looks really, really good. So that was the long answer, Max. The short answer is I don't know.
Real Madrid aren't playing at the Bernabeu. Does that make any difference?
Good question. And a lot of people have been asking this. Now, and Real Madrid are not very happy about this, by the way, because, of course, what happened was that in the discussions with the clubs at the beginning of this, when they were talking about the protocols for returning to training, the protocols for returning to playing, and when they were talking on a less formal level, basically all the clubs were told, look, being realistic, you're not going to get fans in a stadium probably until, not just the end of the season, the end of the year, you know, probably until 2021, there will not be any fans in a stadium. And so Real Madrid and Levante, who are both involved in building works, and indeed Osasuna, although their position's slightly different, decided, right, we're going to accelerate the work we're doing. Because if we're not going to have fans in anyway, we might as well get on with this work. And rather than trying to build around the fans, we'll just get right into this and start working at the Bernabeu. So Madrid are going to play at the training ground. Levante are going to play 150 kilometres away from Valencia. And Osasuna are going to play at home. But of course, they're going to be working around it. Now they're told, because there's been this discussion over the last week, that there's a chance that fans may get back in the stadium during this season, in the next 2 or 3 weeks. In those regions which have gone into phase 4, I think it is, of the de-escalation of the lockdown, that's the governmental de-escalation, not the league's one, they might be allowed fans in. And so Real Madrid, of course, are thinking, but at 30%. But of course, 30% of the Bernabeu is kind of 28,000 people. 30% of Valdebebas, so the Alfredo Di Stefano Stadium where they train and where they're going to play, is barely 1,500 people. And so suddenly they may well be at a huge disadvantage. The other thing that's happened here is that when this was raised, the Consejo Superior de Deportes said, right, we may start to allow fans in, but only at a point to protect the integrity of the competition, only at a point in which everyone can do it. But the president of the league said, well, actually, if clubs can do it, they can do it, whether it's everyone or not. And so there has created this imbalance. Admittedly, it's nowhere near as big as the imbalance in budget from the top to the bottom, but it has created a new element, which I think is now up for debate I don't think we'll see any fans for at least two, maybe 3 weeks. I suspect we won't see any fans again this season, but it is something that's moving now.
What about the race for the top four? You've got Sevilla 47, Sociedad 46, Getafe 46, Atletico 45, and Valencia, whoever manages them, 42. More than 90 minutes is how much danger are Atletico Madrid in of not qualifying for the Champions League, and what does it mean for them if they don't?
Well, given their position and given how strong the teams around them are, you would say the danger is very real. And obviously the danger for them, and danger is the right word, is enormous. You know, they have budgeted to be in the Champions League. You know, their budget makes the assumption they're going to be in the Champions League. And on top of the impact of the pandemic, which for Atletico has been gigantic, so their miss out in the Champions League would be really, really bad news for them. Now, of course, they're still in the competition and they're now saying, well, one way back in, of course, is to go and win it. But we don't know what's happening with that. And Atletico, by the way, have offered for Madrid to host the Champions League if it gets boiled down to kind of like a Final Four structure. And if it can't be held in Turkey or anywhere else, then Madrid maybe would do it. So perhaps they feel there's an advantage there. Although there's a bit of me that thinks you're just setting yourselves up for the inevitable fall now. So Atletico are in danger. And that's one of the interesting things about the return to La Liga is everything's still in play. You know, the top two are only 2 points apart. As you've just said, there are four teams for the remaining two Champions League places and they're very close together. How well they respond, we don't know. Atletico, in theory, if you were to strip this down and say, right, let's have an 11-game league season between Atletico, Getafe, Real Sociedad and Sevilla, would you expect Atletico to finish in the top two? Yeah, you would. But there's no doubt that they're in trouble. And also, bear in mind, this is an Atletico Madrid side that thought it would be competing for the title, not just for a Champions League place this season.
And what relegation looks like, Espanyol, they're 6 points adrift, aren't they? Was it +2 from Leganés, Mallorca, Celta Vigo, Eibar and Valladolid? Who would be the biggest surprise to go?
And I think you can probably expand it slightly above them as well, given that it's 11 games, given that we don't know how teams will respond to playing behind closed doors. Now, again, this is intuitive and we don't know, but you would anticipate, for example, that the impact of playing without fans would be huge for Osasuna and Alaves, who are teams who are just out of that list, you said, but I don't think it's impossible that they get dragged into it. Osasuna shouldn't, but Alaves possibly could. Those three teams, Espanyol, Valladolid and Leganés, that they've all got something that makes you think they could react. But of course, everyone down there has got something. And there was a bit of a reaction from Leganés with a change of manager, a big reaction, in fact, a bit of a reaction from Espanyol with a change of manager. Mallorca have only just slipped into relegation zone and probably have the weakest squad and certainly have the smallest budget. But yeah, all of these things, you sort of just don't know how they can react. And Mallorca, by the way, at Mallorca, they're and this might be clasping at straws, but they're thinking, well, maybe the fact that everyone has to travel to us will make a difference. At a time of kind of heightened sensibility about travel, maybe this will make a difference. But I don't know. I think everyone's just desperate to see something to hold on to, aren't they?
Nicky, Serie A, Juve 63 points, Lazio 62, Inter 54 with a game in hand. Do Inter have a chance?
Well, I think one of the things that's sort of relevant here is that because of the way they've scheduled the catch-up, Inter will play their game in hand first. So that becomes hugely critical in my mind. I think that if Inter can come back with a win over Sampdoria, especially if they've done, you know, who knows, they could have won the cup by then, but if they win that game against Sampdoria, you come back within 6 points and yeah, you're in the conversation at that point. I think they're possibly the most sort of fascinating case study in like what this interruption will have done to a team, because Inter were brilliant at the start of this season. I thought they played I've actually gone back and been watching some of their games recently for some other pieces I've been working on. And I think that the football they played early in the campaign under Antonio Conte was light years ahead of where they've been in recent seasons some of the time. And the problem with it was it was still uneven. Sometimes you'd get a great first half out of them and a really disappointing second half, as happened in the big Champions League games against Barcelona, against Borussia Dortmund. But the football they were capable of playing was brilliant. But they had been stumbling quite a bit before this interruption. They lost the first leg of their semi-final against Napoli. They lost to Lazio in the league and they lost to Juventus in the league, which are their two biggest rivals for the title. And when you look now at some of the numbers, Inter's players have run more distance than any other team in the league this season. They've also had fewer minutes used from their substitutes of any team in the league this season, which tells you something about how Conte is using this team. He's hammering them. He's getting them to work hard. And sometimes when that work rate perhaps can't be sustained, that's when things have gone badly. So in some sense, they look at this break and think, brilliant, you needed that. You could see the results were tapering off, you were tired. So maybe this break is good for Inter. On the other hand, you're about to play up to 15 games in a month and a half. Like, are you actually going to be the most exhausted of anyone. You're going to be the team that, that breaks down from this. So I think Inter are really sort of, I guess, the most sort of extreme end of looking at what's going to happen as a result of this specific situation. They have got some things working in their favour. For instance, Stefan Asensi, who was really important in the first part of the season, being back at full health, which he wasn't, that could be relevant. But there's also some really messy stuff in there, by the way. For instance, that Alexis Sanchez, who's there on loan, should be there until the 30th of June. I still don't feel like this contract situation has been fully worked out for some players. Does he just suddenly get sent home in the middle of the remaining season, or is he, you know, are they going to work that out so that he can stay until the end? I think there's some messy stuff still to be worked out.
I mean, I had completely forgotten where Alexis Sanchez was. I'm finding it quite liberating asking these really base questions. But who's been good for Juve and Lazio, Nicky?
Yeah, I mean, well, Ronaldo was on an extremely good run coming into the interruption. I can't remember the exact numbers, but he was averaging a goal or game or thereabouts, maybe even above for a little while. So Ronaldo was on a great run and, of course, remains essential to Juventus. Higuain is probably the most notable player who's come back from this break and immediately got injured. So now you've got a perhaps sort of new look Juventus attack with Douglas Costa coming in alongside Dybala, who had been playing quite well towards the interruption, and Ronaldo making up the front three. For Lazio, the player's been playing well, everybody. I mean, Lazio have been a sensation this season in terms of how they've been playing. They've played Juventus off the park. They've beaten Inter. Obviously, some of the names have been familiar the last few seasons. Milinkovic-Savic, Ciro Immobile has been continuing to this sort of crazy two-season run he's been on of just scoring. Luis Alberto. But also, it's like peripheral is maybe the wrong word to use, but every sort of not obvious, every non-starting player like Caicedo coming off the bench has been in tremendous form. And I think definitely, again, I know momentum in sport is a massive cliche, whether or not, you know, momentum really exists, whether or not like there's this real sort of thing, but there's definitely a question for me of whether this interruption somehow takes them out of their rhythm, whether not having the conditions they're used to at home games takes them out of their rhythm. Again, it all feels so impossible to know until we actually start playing the games.
Sure. At the bottom, looks like Spalla gone. And then what, anyone from Fiorentina who are 13th down?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say Brescia probably gone as well. So it's one spot, but there's quite a few teams that that could get dragged into that spot. Do you know, that's really another really sort of interesting angle I've heard on this return. So Fiorentina, in my view, are part of that conversation. They're not far enough away in terms of points not to be talked about as part of the relegation conversation. But Arrigo Sacchi suggested he thought they might be one of the teams that does best in this last part of the season because they're the youngest. So is it being young that helps you when you've got a lot of games back-to-back because players recover faster than older players do? So, I don't know. It's an interesting angle, I thought, certainly. And again, who knows? But the relegation battle has got a lot of teams to be dragged into it. I think the Champions League race is still really interesting as well.
Is that Atalanta and Roma, pretty much, would you say, for the fourth spot?
Yeah, I think Napoli have had a very odd season because, of course, they had the infamous dust-up where you have the owner's son coming into the changing room and players, you know, going at him, basically refusing to stay in the enforced sort of training camp that he did away from their families like they were asked to. And there was a really mutinous mood around the team for a while and results were awful. Actually, before this interruption, again, you saw a team that was changing direction a bit. Things had started to get better under Gennaro Gattuso. They did win that cup game against Inter. They did actually, I thought, play really well in the first leg of their Champions League game against Barcelona. So Napoli could yet be in that Champions League conversation, but they've got ground to make up on the others, certainly.
In terms of this season's Champions League, how pleased are you for Atalanta? Because it just seems so unfair that they wouldn't get a chance to progress, given they've been kind of this season's Ajax, you know, compared to last year, haven't they?
Yeah, well, we still don't really know what's happening with the Champions League, do we? We haven't got a clear plan for how that gets finished. I think that if you talk to people from Bergamo, if you talk to fans of the club, the general attitude is, we've already won our Champions League. Doesn't matter. You know, getting there was winning the Champions League. Getting through the group stage was winning the Champions League. Beating Valencia was winning the Champions League. Everything that's happened for them has been success enough. What happens from here on is all a bonus in a footballing sense. I think of all the places where footballing is coming back, that's undoubtedly the place where you're going to get the most conflicted feelings, because Bergamo was the worst hit city in all of Italy by all of this. It was essentially the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak for Italy, even if it wasn't, you know, the very first case. And there's so many layers to that. You know, the most obvious and most meaningful one is just that a lot of people there have lost loved ones, and does football really matter to you as much after that? There's also this sort of side conversation that's come up during the break of Giampiero Gasperini, the manager, saying that when he went to the second leg against Valencia, which the two legs of that game have been talked about as a massive sort of biological disaster for Europe, frankly, of sort of spreading the disease across Europe. But Gasperini said that he thinks he had COVID-19 at the time when those games were played. He sort of talked about it in a way that I found uncomfortable, in the way he talked about it, like it was sort of a light anecdote about how he couldn't taste his food or drink and he was struggling to do stuff. And yeah, that was probably really bloody irresponsible, and you know, not in a sort of small way. I mean, I'm not suggesting that he on his own caused some mass transmission, but it's part of a greater behavior that probably did cause mass transmission. And yeah, I'd definitely be interested to hear what Sid has seen of the reaction to that in Spain as well.
The reaction to that was curious, because the reaction to that, as you can imagine, to start with, was like, what? Seriously? But I was surprised that it didn't then run for longer as a story, or as a sense of irresponsibility, or as something that people commented on and wrote about. It seemed, I suppose in part, it's because people were so kind of taken aback by it. And as you say, he said it as if it was a light anecdote. It was like, hang on, that can't be right. And then yeah, it got left really quite quickly. And I'm sort of surprised how quickly it got left. But yeah, the original reaction was the same as yours. It was like, bloody hell, in the midst of that, it's strange that it hasn't been more.
So look, the Champions League, the idea is to play this mini tournament in Lisbon, it's been suggested at the moment, after the domestic seasons have finished, the final on the 23rd of August. None of us are getting a summer holiday, are we? I mean, I quite like the idea, right, of this mini tournament. It just sounds kind of fun. The four second legs in the last 16 to go is more complicated, because Manchester City at home to Real Madrid, 2-1 up. They want home advantage. Barcelona are 1-1 with Napoli, the second leg due in Spain. They want home advantage. Juve are 1-0 down, bringing Lyon, who won't have played football for months, to Turin. Bayern 3-0 up on Chelsea. I just wondered how we feel about the whole idea of the Champions League finishing, or is that something we shouldn't think about until we've got these domestic seasons done? Archie?
Yeah, if you're Chelsea and your season's done and you're going out and you're 3-0 down to Bayern, I mean, yeah, I'm wondering exactly how they'll go into that game. But it's difficult as well, because you're dealing with a lot of big clubs across the continent here who are all very much used to getting their own way. And particularly in the case of that Man City-Real Madrid game, one party is not going to be happy there. So I think you're right. Like, it's easy to look at how things have gone in Germany and think, as has happened, I think, from other countries' perspectives, oh, okay, well, if they can do it, then why can't we? But who knows? I can't predict how it's going to go in Italy, Spain and England, but I would be surprised if it goes as seamlessly, given the internal conflicts that we've been hearing about there from Nicky and Sid. So I think for a Champions League to take place, particularly having people travel in from different countries, you have to see exactly what the virus is going to do in the next month as well. What if there's another outbreak of that across the continent? But I think that travel is on the whole being restricted. I know that the borders, I know some friends who have gone from Germany to Italy this week. So yeah, I have to see how travel restrictions work as well. I do know, Max, by the way, that the Europa League in a similar way is meant to be finished in Germany. That's just something I wanted to add.
So, I mean, obviously there are a whole load of elements to this, but there's an element to this which I think is interesting, seen from the Spanish point of view at least. And that is that Spanish football coming back is really a big success story for Javier Tebas, the president of the league. But one of the reasons why he's been able to force this through is because quite early on there was a meeting with the CSD, the Consejo Superior de Deportes, which, as I mentioned earlier, is effectively the sports ministry. And that meeting at the start basically brought together the federation and the league, who've been at loggerheads for a very, very long time. But more importantly, it was the beginning of a building of a relationship between Javier Tebas and Irene Lozano, essentially the Secretary of State for Sport. And that meant that at every step throughout this process, there's been effectively, if you like, an ally of La Liga inside the government. So the Consejo Superior de Deportes has been discussing with the Ministry of Health and trying to impress upon them the economic significance of bringing La Liga back. And we're seeing these statistics mentioned again and again and again. Almost 1.4% of the GDP is football, the number of jobs that football employs and so on. And so there's been very significant and very concerted kind of, if you like, political pressure applied by the league on the health ministry through the CSD. So they've almost become allies. And so the CSD has become this bridge, if you like, between the health ministry and the football authorities. And so why is Spanish football back? Because it has been able to negotiate almost directly with political authorities. Well, that's fine within one country. But of course, if you come back to European football, La Liga can't go and negotiate with the British government to make sure that Real Madrid can go to Manchester, for example. Or, you know, or the British government can't go and negotiate directly with the German football authorities and the German government to make sure that Chelsea can travel to Munich. And so you get this, say, and this has been hidden a little bit in Spain. It hasn't been seen. The return of Spanish football is a huge political success based on a lot of commitment being offered by the league and towards the league in return for huge economic backing. By the way, La Liga has spent 25 million euros on propping up non-professional sports. In other words, they've said to that sports ministry, here we go, we'll prop up those Olympic sports because you're desperate to get them back ready for next year's Olympics. We'll pay for that. We'll pay for the federation, which is theoretically a kind of semi-public, semi-private body. We'll pay this money. And in return for this, we want the commitment to help us get back. Now, you can't have those kind of discussions when it comes to European football because you're dealing with too many bodies and too many governments.
Sure. And when you think as well, by the time that game is played, if it is played and this all runs smoothly, Manchester City will know, you know, the CAS have made their verdict. We just don't know what it is. But by then they will know if that's their last Champions League game, possibly for one season or two seasons. So there's just so much riding on that game. Archie, you've been watching football for what, 3 weeks now?
Oh yeah.
You smug bastard. Yeah. Update us. I know we had you very briefly on Monday. It was very brief, and I'm blaming Philippe Auclair for ranting about something or other for that. But
I enjoyed Monday's pod. Yeah. I listened to it. It was very enjoyable. So no, but by all means.
Update us on the key points. You had cup games yesterday, didn't we?
You did. Well, we had the second semi-final between Bayern and Eintracht where, like, for the last few weeks, in the first half, Bayern could have scored quite a few. They only ended up scoring one. And then suddenly, the other team came back into it. And it's like, what? Bayern are beatable? Eintracht Frankfurt equalised through Danny Da Costa. But then, have we been watching The Last Dance, all of us
yes,
here?
Yes, we have. Yeah, I have.
You know how Michael Jordan then has this moment where he's like, I took that personally. Like, basically, every time that Bayern Munich score right now, it's like they're having their Michael Jordan and I took that personally moment. Because right. Then they just come back with a vengeance. And, like, within 5 minutes, they score. And you're like, okay, like, they're looking really tasty right now. And the team that they beat at the weekend, Leverkusen, were facing fourth-tier Saarbrücken, which is a fantastic story that they got this far. The first ever fourth-tier team to reach the semi-finals of the German Cup. But if you're playing, like, I think the whole thing with cup football is that if it's about the fans being able to swing it, and it was a particularly dodgy pitch that they're playing on as well. But Leverkusen were just too good for them. They were out of sight already in the first half, meaning that the final will be Bayern against Leverkusen in early July. And yeah, given what I saw when Leverkusen played Bayern at the weekend, Bayern winning 4-2, I struggle to bet against Bayern the way they're playing right now because they're sensational.
Harry writes, how many players can we expect Borussia Dortmund to lose before the 2021 season, given that a second, third place finish is looking increasingly likely, and another club prepared for those outgoings? I mean, it looks like Bayern are running away with the league now. So the implications for Dortmund are what?
I think it's pretty clear that Jadon Sancho would like to move at the end of this season. Whether that's going to happen, whether Dortmund will get the right deal that they want is another question. But look, otherwise, I think the majority of that squad is sticking around. We know that Mario Götze is moving off at the end of the season. They couldn't agree a new deal with him, but that's been clear for some time. And I would expect Erling Haaland to stick around for now. I I think he knows that it's best for his development to stick around. I think it would be best for Jadon Sancho's development to stick around. But I think that Sancho will probably end up moving this summer. I would be surprised if a Premier League club doesn't end up throwing silly money at him, if that's Manchester United, particularly given the fact that he's got allies there in the Manchester United dressing room. We had Sportbild this week commenting how he's good mates with Jesse Lingard and Marcus Rashford. He is the sort of player who can go and win a game on his own. And I think United could probably do with a player like that going forward right now. But I don't expect Dortmund to be completely torn asunder. It's just that, are they going to be ahead of this Bayern side who are signing Leroy Sané this summer, albeit that's not officially confirmed yet, and also looking to sign Kai Havertz if they can? It's difficult to see anyone pulling past Bayern right now, which I guess is yeah, a bit sad from the league's point of view, because this will be number 8 in a row. But yeah,
it is in a way. But you know, if Bayern win the League and Cup and the Champions League, which they could do, then sometimes you have to stand back a bit, like, you know, the Chicago Bulls. You have to stand back and go, we're just watching a great team here be great.
Yeah, agreed.
Yes, thank you. Can we talk about football fans in forests, please, Archie?
We can. So Union Berlin, who promoted at the beginning of this season, who've been a great addition to the league, they play at the Stadion an der Alten Försterei, which literally means like the stadium at the Old Forest, at the Old Forestry. And as a result, they're right next to a nice bit of forest. And after the game against Bayern, where a couple of fans were hiding in trees and got pulled out of them or told to come down, before this game against Schalke this weekend, they had fans who were standing in the woods. They had about 30 of them who you could hear very audibly on the TV singing and supporting Union throughout the game.
So hang on, they're in the woods. They can't see the action. They're watching it on their phones, right?
But no. They're just seeing... I don't even know if they were watching the game, but they just knew that they were like... that the game's going on. At the end of the game, they were singing, we want to see the players, we want to see the team. And the team all came over, and there's this lovely picture of the players standing on the tables in the stadium beer garden so they can see and applaud the fans over the wall. But the police were aware of this happening, but because they're not on stadium property and they were all socially distanced, standing apart in the requisite number that you need to be in groups, the police didn't do anything. It was all in order. But yeah, I don't think there's any other stadium really where you could do that with quite the same effect as the Union fans did. So yeah.
Sid, didn't something similar happen with Raya Vallecano yesterday?
Yeah. So Raya Vallecano, and a lot of the listeners will know this, but Raya Vallecano stadium only has three sides. At one end, it's just a wall, and there's I think it's three blocks of flats directly behind that wall. So obviously you've got four or five floors in each of those blocks of flats that directly look over the pitch. Yesterday, they weren't full, but there's always some people on the balcony. So there's a really, really nice photograph actually from Pablo Garcia, who's done some of the photographs for The Guardian before, looking down from one of the balconies of that flat. And you see this wall and there's two fans just trying to look over the top of the wall to watch the game and the players playing just the other side of it. And this wall is very thin. You know, these people are probably only 2 meters away from the action, but there's a wall in the way. And then there's a really nice photograph as well of after the Raya Vallecano goal, on one of those balconies is a dad and his daughter, a dad and his child anyway, both of them in Raya Vallecano kits celebrating the goal, which they're watching from a tower block.
Nicky, you were saying before the pod, Crotone have a good story about fans trying to watch but not buy tickets in years gone by.
Yeah, well, when Crotone came up to Serie A, the stadium was not equipped for the level of demand for some games, and certainly the most memorable one was when Juventus came to play away. And Crotone Stadium has a hospital overlooking it, and so there were a lot of stories at the time about fans basically coming up with reasons to get themselves admitted to hospital for the day so that they could look out the window and see Juventus. A little harder to imagine.
You're probably
in the
right
climate. But Serie B is also coming back, so there will be games played there.
It's very hard to know to get the right room, isn't it? You know, you, if you just you, you know, you have an unnecessary knee operation and then you you find out you're looking at the other side of the hospital would be a disappointment, wouldn't it? On the subject of adding atmosphere, Craig wrote this, with no Barry on Football Weekly this week, as with lockdown football, is there going to be an option of having his breathing or miserableness artificially piped over the recording to aid with making things feel a little bit more normal? Right, look, we've talked for a long time. That'll do for part two. Part three, we will answer some of your questions and round up any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. There's obviously lots of news from the Premier League, the Football League as well. So on Monday, we're going to look at women's football in the Football League. On Tuesday, we're going to start looking ahead to the Premier League. So I'll just finish this pod with some questions for you lot. Stuart says, Scottish football has had the suggestion of cult clubs in lower leagues, and people in favour always cite other countries do it and it helps the international side. Spain, for example, does it really do anything? Do Spanish fans enjoy seeing the Barca B team against their team, and does it help the Spanish international team?
Well, I mean, one of the argument about the fact that Spanish B teams play in the national league, so they can reach as high as the second division, because they're of course not allowed to play in the same division as their first team. And this, you know, this obviously takes us right back to, I think it was 1980, but it might be 1981. I must admit, my mind's gone blank. Real Madrid played their own youth team in the Copa del Rey final. And so you know, it has happened before. That's the reason why the B teams don't play in the cup anymore. The argument with this is that the development at those clubs and for those players accelerates by playing professional football with the intensity and the aggression and so on, rather than playing against other youth teams. For the teams who play against them, to be honest, I think it just becomes almost an irrelevance, because, of course, as you can imagine, Barca B, Atletico B, Real Madrid's B team, even Celta's B team, whatever. Imagine they go to a team like, I don't know, for example, I've seen Celta B and Real Madrid B and Atletico B play at Fuenlabrada when they're in the Segunda B. Fuenlabrada fans just don't really care, because that team doesn't bring any away fans. Yeah, they're wearing Real Madrid kits and some of them might end up being really big, but it sort of doesn't feel like a special occasion. If anything, it feels slightly more flat than a normal game. But it's so ingrained as part of the whole process now that I don't think anyone looks at it as being particularly strange.
There's a very famous example of second teams here almost doing too well, which is that the Hertha Berlin second team actually reached the German Cup final in 1993 and lost to Bayer Leverkusen in the final.
Did they bring any ringers in from Hertha first team?
I don't think they did. They only lost 1-0 as well. And there's a little bit of an irony there as well, because Hertha Berlin have been so desperate to reach a final in their own stadium, and yet the only team that's been able to do it has been their second team.
Hans says, which player will return in the worst shape from each respective league? Archie, did any Bundesliga player arrive having forgotten to do any training?
I remember people were actually having a bit of a go at Jadon Sancho for some reason, saying, oh, look at the shape he's in. But that's not made sense, given the fact that he's got 17 goals and 17 assists and was just coming off the back of an injury anyway. And yeah, that's bollocks, to be honest.
I mean, if you're saying Jadon Sancho is fat, there is no hope,
right?
for the whole of society.
Didn't Gonzalo Higuain come back looking a little bit podgy?
Yeah, Higuain came back looking not in his best shape and then immediately pulled the muscle, which was reported by at least one place I saw as a muscle in his bum, which just felt funnier to be in fact. Coming back looking a little bit...
He's always had a little bit of a pop.
I think this is like an unfortunate part of this for some footballers. I think Higuain is one of those people who, even when he's in really good shape, like just the shape of his torso makes it look like he's carrying more than he is. But yeah, it certainly wasn't a good look to get injured right away as well.
Bear Jones says, how has the Ham Garage fared under quarantine, Sid?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's been there as a kind of, you know, like when you're on a train, it says break glass in case of emergency. The Ham has been the equivalent of that. You know, we really are in a position where we have to self-isolate and we can't even get to a supermarket. The Ham is there to rescue us. Fortunately, so far, we've not needed to break the glass.
Excellent. Finally, Archer, you messaged me yesterday to say, after long consideration, I'm happy to provide a closing chapter to Tindergate tomorrow.
Today, I would like to announce that there has been a mutual termination of the Tinder deal that was in place. Both parties have placed their thanks on record and wish each other all the best for the future. Statement ends.
Who dumped who?
Statement ends.
All right. Thank you very much, Archie, for that official statement. And thanks for also for all the messages about the Black Lives Matter pod we did with Troy Elliott and Jordan yesterday. And I hate to sound like this major corporation, we take this really seriously, but we do really take it seriously and have already started talking to the bosses at our sort of record of representation on the pods. It is way better than it was 2 or 3 years ago, especially the number of women we have on the pods. Also, we have more BAME contributors, but it's not enough and it'll get better. And do call us out if it doesn't. We'll be back on Monday. Flo Lloyd-Hughes, Susie Rack, George Ellick will explain all the fallout of the EFL and the women's game. On Tuesday, Baz is back and we investigate the life and times of Jonathan Liu. And we'll look ahead to the Premier League's return. But for today, Nikki, thanks so much for your time. Thank you, Sid. Thank you, Archie. See you on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.